Could a body be shared by two or more selves? The condition known as dissociative identity disorder, it used to be called multiple personality disorder, is apparently an example of many selves sharing a single body with a dominant self, the host, and a group of alters. I say apparently because controversy rages about the diagnosis, running from outright fraud through folie à deux, in which a naive psychiatrist unintentionally encourages a troubled patient to develop the symptoms, to acceptance of a few rare and genuine cases surrounded by various flavors of wannabes. After studying the phenomenon, and the people studying and treating the phenomenon, for several years, psychologist Nicholas Humphrey and I, 1989, decided that everyone is right. There are frauds, exaggerations, gullible therapists with eager patients, and yes, a few cases in which the condition seems to have existed in at least rudimentary form prior to any elaboration at the hands of a fascinated interlocutor. This is not surprising when we recognize that it is an intensification of something quite normal that we all experience to various degrees. Most of us lead several fairly distinct lives, at work, at home, at play, and acquire habits and memories in each context that turn out not to travel well to other contexts. As sociologist Irving Goffman, 1959, recounted in his classic book on the subject, The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life, we all engage in presenting ourselves as characters in real-life dramas. Professor Dennett, Dan from up the road, Dad, Grandpa, etc. And we effortlessly enlist the help of the supporting cast who are similarly presenting themselves. We feed each other lines we can handle readily, becoming complicit in each other's campaign of self-presentation. Or we can disrupt these smoothly running scenarios by playing out of character, with results that are awkward, comic, or worse. It takes nerves of steel to do this. Can you imagine asking a person newly introduced to you at a party to show you some identification, a driver's license perhaps, or a passport? Or heading in the other direction, attempting to give her a passionate embrace? When people are put in extremely difficult positions, they sometimes adopt extreme measures, and what starts out as feigning and desperation becomes almost second nature. When the going gets tough, you simply depart, leaving behind a different center of narrative gravity, a different character better equipped to deal with the problem at hand. Humphrey and I learned that when you interview a putative sufferer of dissociative identity disorder, expect to find a naive virtuoso in the art of deflecting obtrusive inquiry, to raise the questions that cry out for answers, or, better, to set little traps to see whether one alter really doesn't have any memories of what the other alter was doing and saying. You will have to be downright rude and risk giving serious offense. So, in all likelihood, you will find yourself politely going along with a gag, an accomplice enlisted without so much as a wink. Con artists do this deliberately, with great skill, but so do innocent victims of this personality disorder, without any recognition of what they are doing. So do we all to one degree or another. But their alters are just fictional characters, right? The real person is the host, right? Well, it isn't quite that straightforward. That thing that is you, the person you play, whether you play multiple roles or really just one monolithic role, is your center of narrative gravity. It is how your friends recognize you. You're not yourself today. And how you see yourself for the most part. But it is also somewhat idealized. Oh my God, did I do that? I would never do that. Professional novelists, like con artists, create narratives with cunning and deliberate attention to the details. The rest of us are talented amateurs, spinning our tails cleverly, but, in the main, unwittingly, rather the way a spider spins a web. It is nature, not art. It is not so much that we, using our brains, spin our yarns, as that our brains, using yarns, spin us. There is a core of undeniable true biography, to be sure, but over the years, large parts of it become as good as gone, inert, and of no relevance to who you are now. Some of it you may actively disavow, jettison, forget in the process of self-maintenance and self-improvement. Consider how easily you can answer some questions about your past. Have you ever danced with a movie star? Have you ever been to Paris? Have you ever ridden a camel? Have you ever strangled somebody to death with your bare hands? These are easy for almost all of us, whether the answer is yes or no. Imagine someone who was asked the last question and who paused, thoughtfully scratching his chin before answering. Give him a wide berth. We know the answers to these questions because we know enough about ourselves, our selves, to know that had we ever danced with a movie star, been to Paris, ridden a camel, or strangled someone, we'd now be recollecting it. When nothing comes to mind, we interpret this absence as a negative. How else could we be so sure? Do you keep a list of all the things you've never done, all the places you've never been? Contrast those questions with these superficially similar questions. Have you ever danced with a person named Smith? Have you ever been to a drugstore that sold floor polish? Have you ever ridden in a blue Chevrolet? Have you ever broken a white coffee mug? Some may be easy to answer, and others may lead you to say you have no idea, and some may inspire you to give false answers without realizing it, just because they are so unimportant. Why would you remember it if you had done any of these things? A lot that has happened to us is just not memorable. A lot of things that we have done, good and bad, have been shed by our centers of narrative gravity. And a lot that never happened has been added, innocently enough, because for one reason or another it just fits us to a T. What you are is that rolling sum of experience and talent, solemn intention and daydreaming fantasy, bound together in one brain and body and called by a given name. The idea that there is, in addition, a special indissoluble nugget of you or ego or spirit or soul is an attractive fantasy, but nothing that we need in order to make sense of people, their dreams and hopes, their heroism and their sins. This center of narrative gravity may not be a mysterious nugget of mind stuff, but if it is just an abstraction, can it be studied scientifically? Yes, it can. 63. Heterophenomenology. Heterophenomenology is not an intuition pump, but another example of staging that is well worth putting in place before we tackle some difficult questions. The study of human consciousness involves phenomena that, at first glance, seem to occur in something rather like another dimension, the private, subjective, first-person dimension that each of us occupies with regard to our own consciousness, and to which nobody else can gain direct access. What, then, is the relation between the standard third-person objective methodologies for studying meteors or magnets, or human metabolism or bone density, and the methodologies for studying human consciousness? Do we have to create some radical or revolutionary alternative science, or can the standard methods be extended in such a way as to do justice to the phenomena of human consciousness? I defend the claim that there is a straightforward, conservative extension of objective science that handsomely covers all the ground of human consciousness, doing justice to all the data without ever having to abandon the rules and constraints of the experimental methods that have worked so well in the rest of science. This third-person methodology, heterophenomenology, phenomenology of an other, not oneself, is the sound way to take the first-person point of view as seriously as it can legitimately be taken. Why the multisyllabic name? Phenomenology originally meant a catalog of phenomena of one sort or another, before there is a good theory of them. In the 16th century, William Gilbert compiled a good phenomenology of magnetism. But it was centuries before all the magnetic phenomena he carefully described could be explained. In the early 20th century, Edmund Husserl and a group of psychologists and philosophers influenced by him adopted the term phenomenology, with a capital P, for a presumably scientific study of the phenomena of subjective experience to be observed using a first-person introspective method that attempted to be theory-neutral and without presuppositions. The school of thought continues to this day, embattled or ignored for the most part, for reasons good and bad. In spite of some very tantalizing results, well worth further exploration, as a first-person approach, it has been shunned by objective, empirical science, which insists on data that can be accessible to all investigators. But we can study consciousness objectively, and the method is really just a simple twist on phenomenology, so I call it heterophenomenology. To contrast it with Husserlian autophenomenology. Heterophenomenology is the study of first-person phenomena from the third-person point of view of objective science. Obviously, the key difference between experiments with rocks, roses, and rats on the one hand, and experiments with awake, cooperative human subjects on the other, is that the latter can communicate in language and hence can collaborate with experimenters by making suggestions, interacting verbally, and telling them what it is like under various controlled conditions. That is the core of heterophenomenology. It exploits our capacity to perform and interpret speech acts, yielding a catalog of what the subject believes to be true about his or her conscious experience. This catalog of beliefs fleshes out the subject's heterophenomenological world, the world according to S, the subjective world of one subject. The total set of details of heterophenomenology, plus all the data we can gather about concurrent events in the brains of subjects and in the surrounding environment, comprise the total data set a theory of human consciousness must explain. It leaves out no objective phenomena and no subjective phenomena of consciousness. The interpretation required to turn raw data about speech sounds and button pressings into reports and expressions of beliefs involves adopting the intentional stance. It requires the working hypothesis that the subject is an agent whose actions are rationally guided by beliefs and desires that are themselves rational, given the subject's perceptual history and needs. For instance, the constraints of the intentional stance can be clearly discerned in the standard precautions taken in such experiments to prevent subjects from having experiences that might give them either beliefs or desires that would tend to bias their responses in ways that would distort our interpretation of their actions. We keep them in the dark about what we hope they will say, for instance, while at the same time taking steps to assure ourselves that they understand the tasks we set them. This adoption of the intentional stance is not an irreparably subjective and relativistic affair. Rules of interpretation can be articulated. Standards of intersubjective agreement on interpretation can be set and met. Deviations can be identified. The unavoidable assumption of rationality can be cautiously couched and treated as an adjustable, defensible, and evolutionarily explicable assumption. The details of these processes are articulated in Dennett, 1991a. This is not a proposal for a new methodology for studying consciousness. I am just being self-conscious about the standard methods already adopted by researchers in cognitive psychology, psychophysics, which studies the relationships between physical stimuli and subjective reactions, and neuroscience, and explaining and defending them. These methods, correctly understood and followed, obviate the need for any radical or revolutionary first-person science of consciousness, and leave no residual phenomena of consciousness inaccessible to controlled scientific study. What kinds of things does this methodology commit us to? Beyond the unproblematic things all of science is committed to, neurons and electrons, clocks and microscopes, it commits us just to beliefs, the beliefs expressed by subjects and deemed constitutive of their subjectivity, and to desires, the desires to cooperate with the experimenters, and to tell them the truth as candidly as possible. An important part of the method involves controlling these beliefs and desires, and any experimental result that shows evidence of failure to do this must be discarded. What kinds of things are beliefs and desires? We may stay maximally noncommittal about this, pending the confirmation of theory, by treating beliefs and their contents, or objects, as theorists' fictions or abstractions similar to centers of mass, the equator, and parallelograms of forces. Mermaid sightings are real events, however misdescribed, whereas mermaids don't exist. Similarly, a catalog of beliefs about experience is not the same as a catalog of experiences themselves. Philosopher Joseph Levine, 1994, page 117, has objected that conscious experiences themselves, not merely our verbal judgments about them, are the primary data to which a theory must answer. This can't be right. How, in advance of theory, could we catalog the experiences themselves? Consider the evidence we get from putting subjects into experimental situations and querying them, and asking them to perform whatever other actions we want them to perform. These sources are naturally nested by the cascade of interpretations we have to perform, ranked here from least raw to most raw. A. Conscious experiences themselves. B. Beliefs about these conscious experiences. C. The verbal judgments Levine mentions. D. The utterances of one sort or another that can be interpreted to express those verbal judgments. In one sense of primary, the utterances are primary data, recorded sounds and motions. Electroencephalographic EEG readings and functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI readings, and the like can be added to the primary data as circumstances permit. Reliable methods of interpretation can take us to C and B, so we have a catalog of subjects' beliefs about what it is like to be them under these conditions. But should we push on to A in advance of theory? This is not a good idea for two reasons. First, if A outruns B, if you have conscious experiences you don't believe you have, then those extra conscious experiences are just as inaccessible to you as to the external observers. So Levine's proposed alternative garners no more usable data than heterophenomenology does. Second, if B outruns A, if you believe you have conscious experiences that you don't in fact have, then it is your beliefs that we need to explain, not the non-existent experiences. Sticking to the heterophenomenological standard, then, and treating B as the maximal set of primary data is the way to avoid any commitment to spurious data, while ensuring that all phenomena accessible to anybody get included. What if some beliefs are inexpressible in verbal judgments? There is nothing to prevent heterophenomenologists and subjects from collaborating on devising analog or other non-linguistic modes of belief expression. For instance, drawing a vertical line across a line segment indicating how intense, in one dimension or another, the experience is, from barely noticeable to overpowering. Or subjects can press a button with variable pressure to indicate severity of pain, or anxiety, or boredom, or even distrust in the experiment. Then there are a host of physiological-dependent variables to measure, from galvanic skin response and heart rate to changes in facial expression and posture. And if you, the subject, believe that there are still ineffable residues unconveyed after exhausting such methods, you can tell this to the heterophenomenologists who can add that belief to the list of beliefs in your primary data. S claims that he has ineffable beliefs about X. If this belief is true, then science has the obligation to explain what such beliefs are and why they are ineffable. If this belief is false, science still has to explain why S believes, falsely, that there are these particular ineffable beliefs. 64. Mary, the Color Scientist, a Boom Crutch Unveiled. Australian philosopher Frank Jackson's thought experiment about Mary, the Color Scientist, often called the knowledge argument, has been pumping philosophers' intuitions with remarkable vigor since it first appeared in 1982. For sheer volume and reliability, this must count as one of the most successful intuition pumps ever devised by an analytical philosopher. It is a classic, perennially on the list of required reading in undergraduate courses in the philosophy of mind all over the English-speaking world, and several weighty anthologies have been devoted to essays reflecting on its implications. It is interesting to note that its author has subsequently recanted, declaring that he no longer accepts its conclusion, but that has not diminished its popularity. Here it is in its entirety, drawn slightly out of context perhaps, but still clear as can be. Mary is a brilliant scientist who is, for whatever reason, forced to investigate the world from a black and white room via a black and white television monitor. She specializes in the neurophysiology of vision and acquires, let us suppose, all the physical information there is to obtain about what goes on when we see ripe tomatoes or the sky and use terms like red, blue, and so on. She discovers, for example, just which wavelength combinations from the sky stimulate the retina and exactly how this produces, via the central nervous system, the contraction of the vocal cords and expulsion of air from the lungs that results in the uttering of the sentence, "The sky is blue." It can hardly be denied that it is, in principle, possible to obtain all this physical information from black and white television. Otherwise, the Open University would, of necessity, need to use color television. What will happen when Mary is released from her black and white room or is given a color television monitor? Will she learn anything or not? It seems just obvious that she will learn something about the world and our visual experience of it. But then, it is inescapable that her previous knowledge was incomplete. But she had all the physical information, ergo, there is more to have than that. And physicalism, that is to say materialism, the denial of dualism, is false. Jackson, 1982, page 130. Is it a good intuition pump? Let's turn all the knobs and see what makes it work. Actually, that would take us too long, but the job has been done in the sizable literature on the topic. Here I will simply illustrate a few knobs that need to be examined and leave the result as an exercise for you. If you want, you can check your own results against the literature. Can you come up with a new twist? More than 20 years ago, I conducted a preliminary exploration of the knobs and issued a killjoy verdict that has been largely dismissed or disregarded. Like a good thought experiment, its point is immediately evident even to the uninitiated. In fact, it is a bad thought experiment, an intuition pump that actually encourages us to misunderstand its premises. Dennett, 1991A, page 398. Let's see if this is so. I claim that it is much more difficult to imagine the scenario correctly than people suppose. So they imagine something easier and draw their conclusions from that mistaken base. First knob. A black and white room via a black and white television monitor. Presumably, she wears black or white gloves and is forbidden to look at herself when she bathes, but the idea of cutting off all external sources of color is forlorn in any case. Would we have to rig some device that prevented her from rubbing her eyes to create phosphenes? Try it. And couldn't she have colors in her dreams before actually seeing them? If not, why not? Do the colors have to get in via the eyes before she can store them in her brain? A tangle of bad folk theory of color lies behind this simple suggestion. Second knob. She acquires, let us suppose, all the physical information there is to obtain about what goes on when we see ripe tomatoes or the sky and use terms like red, blue, and so on. All the physical information there is to obtain? How much is that? Is that like having all the money in the world? What would that be like? It's not easy to imagine, and nothing less than all will serve to make the thought experiment's intended point. It must include all the information about all the variation in responses in all the brains, including her own, especially including all the emotional or affective reactions to all the colors under all conditions. So she will know in exquisite detail which colors calm her, annoy her, would grow on her with exposure, distract her, repel her, and so on. Is she forbidden to perform experiments on herself, without cheating, without smuggling any colored things into her cell? If you didn't imagine all this and more, you didn't follow directions. It's like being asked to conceive of a chiliagon and imagining a circle instead. Lots of implications follow from one of these exercises of mental representation that don't follow from the other. In this case, for instance, are we supposed to ignore the fact that if Mary acquired all this information, she would no doubt be in a state of total mental collapse, burdened with thousands of encyclopedia articles and diagrams? If Jackson had stipulated that Mary had the godlike property of being physically omniscient, not just about color, but about every physical fact at every level from the quark to the galaxy, many, if not all, readers would resist, saying that imagining such a feat is just too fantastical to take seriously. But stipulating that Mary knows merely all the physical facts about color vision is not substantially less fantastical. Imagine that Mary has a billion heads. Don't be silly. Okay, make it a million heads. No problem. Really? In an earlier attempt to dramatize this problem of imagination, I encouraged people to consider a variant ending. And so one day, Mary's captors decided it was time for her to see colors. As a trick, they prepared a bright blue banana to present as her first color experience ever. Mary took one look at it and said, "Hey, you tried to trick me. Bananas are yellow, but this one is blue." Her captors were dumbfounded. How did she do it? "Simple," she replied. "You have to remember that I know everything. Absolutely everything that could ever be known about the physical causes and effects of color vision. So, of course, before you brought the banana in, I had already written down in exquisite detail exactly what physical impression a yellow object, or a blue object, or a green object, etc., would make on my nervous system. so I already knew exactly what thoughts I would have. Because after all, the mere disposition to think about this or that is not one of your famous qualia, is it? I was not in the slightest surprised by my experience of Blue. What surprised me was that you would try such a second-rate trick on me. I realize it is hard for you to imagine that I could know so much about my reactive dispositions that the way Blue affected me came as no surprise. Of course it's hard for you to imagine. It's hard for anyone to imagine the consequences of someone knowing absolutely everything physical about anything. Dennett, 1991A, pages 399 to 400. It is standardly assumed that things could not proceed this way. As Jackson disarmingly put it, it seems just obvious that she will learn something about the world and our visual experience of it. Or as George Graham and Terry Horgan, 2000, page 72, say, surely, ding, we submit, she should be both surprised and delighted. That is a mistake, and that is what is wrong with Mary as a thought experiment. It just feels so good to conclude that Mary has a revelation of some sort when she first sees color that nobody wants to bother showing that this is how the story must go. In fact, it needn't go that way at all. Jackson's intuition pump excellently exposes to the light a lot of naive thinking about the nature of color experience and the brain that no doubt serves people well most of the time, so we might grant that he nicely draws out some of the implications of folk theory. But his aim was to refute a hypothesis about the capacity of the physical sciences to account for all color phenomena. Of course, in any real-world situation, somebody in Mary's imagined position would learn something new because, however much she knew about color, there would be lots of facts about physical effects of color she didn't know. It is only the stipulated extreme case that makes Jackson's just obvious and Graham and Horgan's surely out of place. If you are still inclined to think that my suggested alternative ending of the story would have to be impossible, see if you can work out an argued reason for your belief. It would be interesting to see if you come up with a consideration that has escaped the hundreds of philosophers who have labored over this for years. Of course, that very fact might be taken to show that this is, after all, a wonderful intuition pump. It has provided employment for philosophers for three decades. Summary. A besetting problem for the scientific study of consciousness has been the fact that everybody is an expert. Not really, of course, but just about everybody who has reflected for more than a few minutes on the topic seems to think the deliverances of those reflections are as authoritative as the results of any high-tech experiment or any mountain of statistics. It can be downright comical to hear them during the question-and-answer sessions at scientific conferences, firmly correcting the mistakes they have just detected in the presenter's work by citing a recent experience they think they had. If we were, as these people typically think, infallible judges of the nature of our own personal experiences, they would be right. But you can misremember, misinterpret, misdescribe your own most intimate experiences, covertly driven by some persuasive but unreliable bit of ideology. Here is a simple demonstration you can perform at home that may surprise you. Sit in front of a mirror so you can monitor your own compliance with the directions, which are to stare intently into your own eyes, fixating on them as a target, instead of letting your eyes get attracted to peripheral goings-on. Now, without looking, take a card from the middle of a well-shuffled deck of cards and hold it face side toward you at arm's length, just outside the boundaries of your peripheral vision. Wiggle the card. You will know you are doing it, but you won't see it, of course. Start moving the card into your field of view, wiggling it as you do so. First, you can see motion, the wiggling, but no color. You can't tell whether it's a red card or a black card or a face card, and you certainly can't identify its number. As you move it more and more centrally, you will be amazed at how close to straight ahead it has to be for you to identify its color or the fact that it is a face card or not. As the card gets closer and closer to your fixation point, you must concentrate on not cheating, stealing a glance at the card as it moves in. When you are finally able to identify the card, it is almost directly in front of you. Surprising? I don't know anybody who wasn't surprised the first time they experienced this. Here you've thought all along that your vision was roughly equally detailed and colored all the way out to the periphery. And now you learn that although that seems to stand to reason and seems confirmed by casual introspection, it is simply not true. This is just one dimension, one phenomenon among many, in which the apparently rich, continuous, detailed presentation of the world in our visual consciousness is an illusion. The moral is unmistakable. Don't think you understand the phenomena of consciousness until you see what science has discovered about it in recent years. The armchair theories of philosophers who ignore this moral are negligible at best, and more often deeply confused and confusing. What you learn about your consciousness through introspection is a minor but powerfully misleading portion of what we can learn about your consciousness by adopting the heterophenomenological framework and studying consciousness systematically. There are still difficulties aplenty in need of resolution, hard problems that are not the hard problem. If when we have solved all these easy problems, there is still a deeply mysterious residue, it will then be time to reconsider our starting point and cast about for some radical departure from current assumptions about biology, physics, and even logic. In the meantime, let's see how far we can get with business-as-usual science, the science that has brought us our current understanding of everything from asteroids and plate tectonics to reproduction, growth, repair, and metabolism in living things. 8. Tools for thinking about free will. The chasm between the manifest image and the scientific image is at its most treacherous when the topic is free will. Like the questions of what color is, what it really is, and what dollars are, really, when you get right down to it, the question of whether free will is an illusion or something we actually have invites us to use the scientific image to investigate this issue, which is posed in the traditional terms of the manifest image. And the invitation has been enthusiastically accepted in recent years. There has been quite a chorus of eminent scientists saying, point blank, that free will is an illusion. Neuroscientists Wolf Singer, Chris Frith, and Patrick Haggard, psychologists Paul Bloom and Daniel Wegener, and a few rather well-regarded physicists, Stephen Hawking and Albert Einstein. Could so many brilliant scientists be wrong? Many, not all, and maybe not most, philosophers say yes. They say this is a job for philosophy. Are they right? I think so. The scientists have typically been making a rookie mistake, confusing the manifest image with what we might call the folk ideology of the manifest image. The folk ideology of color is, let's face it, bonkers. Color just isn't what most people think it is. But that doesn't mean that the manifest world doesn't really have any colors. It means that colors, real colors, are quite different from what most folks think they are. The folk ideology of consciousness is also bonkers, resolutely dualistic and Mysterian. If that were what consciousness had to be, then right would be right. See page 313. We have to say that consciousness doesn't exist. But we don't have to treat consciousness as real magic, the kind that doesn't exist made of wonder tissue. We can recognize the reality of consciousness as a phenomenon by acknowledging that folks don't yet have a sound ideology about it. Similarly, free will isn't what some of the folk ideology of the manifest image proclaims it to be, a sort of magical isolation from causation. I've compared free will in this sense to levitation, and one of the philosophical defenders of this bonkers vision has frankly announced that a free choice is a little miracle. I wholeheartedly agree with the scientific chorus that that sort of free will is an illusion, but that doesn't mean that free will is an illusion in any morally important sense. It is as real as colors, as real as dollars. Unfortunately, some of the scientists who now declare that science has shown that free will is an illusion go on to say that this discovery matters in a morally important sense. They think it has major implications for morality and the law. Nobody is ever really responsible, for instance, so nobody ever deserves to be either punished or praised. They are making the mistake people make when they say that nothing is ever solid, not really. They are using an unreconstructed popular concept of free will when they should be adjusting it first, the way they do with color and consciousness, and space and time and solidity and all the other things that the ideology of the manifest image gets wrong. The intuition pumps in this part are designed to wean you from that ideology about free will and get you to see a better concept. The concept of real free will, practical free will, the phenomenon in the manifest image that matters. The controversies that have swirled around the topic of free will for several millennia are too many and too tangled to be settled in any one part or book, but we have to start somewhere. And these are thinking tools that work rather like crowbars, jimmying you out of well-worn ruts into rather new terrain with better perspectives. The first is designed to show why this is such an important task. 65. A truly nefarious neurosurgeon. We are at the dawn of neurosurgical treatment of debilitating psychological conditions. Deep brain stimulation by implanted electrodes is showing striking effects in treating obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD, for instance. As reported in a pioneering study by neuropsychiatrist Damian Deniz and his colleagues, 2010, in Amsterdam. That is fact, but this is fiction. One day, a brilliant neurosurgeon said to a patient on whom she had just performed an implantation procedure in her shiny, high-tech operating theater, "The device I've implanted doesn't just control your OCD. It controls your every decision thanks to our master control system, which maintains radio contact with your microchip 24 hours a day. In other words, I've disabled your conscious will. Your sense of free will henceforth will be an illusion." In fact, she had done no such thing. This was simply a lie she decided to tell her patient to see what would happen. It worked. The poor fellow went out into the world convinced that he was not a responsible agent, but rather a mere puppet, and his behavior began to show it. He became irresponsible, aggressive, and negligent, indulging his worst whims until he got caught and put on trial. Testifying in his own defense, he passionately protested his non-responsibility because of the implant in his brain. And the neuroscientist, when called to testify, admitted what she had said and added, "But I was just messing with his head, a practical joke, that's all. I never thought he'd believe me." It really doesn't matter whether the court believed his testimony or hers, whether it sentenced him or her. Either way, she ruined his life with her ill-considered assertion, robbing him of his integrity and crippling his power to make decisions. In fact, her false debriefing of her patient actually accomplished, non-surgically, much of what she claimed to accomplish surgically. She disabled him. But if she is responsible for this dire consequence, the neuroscientists currently filling the media with talk about how their science shows that free will is an illusion are risking mass production of the same harm to all the people who take them at their word. Neuroscientists, psychologists, and philosophers need to take seriously their moral obligation to think through the presuppositions and implications of their public pronouncements on these issues with the same care that is demanded of people who hold forth on global warming or impending asteroid strikes. For just one example, consider the message that Wiley social critic and observer Tom Wolfe, 2000, page 100, finds in the pronouncements of these neuroscientists. "The conclusion people out beyond the laboratory walls are drawing is, the fix is in, we're all hardwired. That, and don't blame me, I'm wired wrong." Wired wrong? What would it be then to be wired right, or have scientists discovered that nobody is, or could be, wired right for moral responsibility? 66. A deterministic toy, Conway's game of life. When physicist Richard Feynman found himself listening to a scientific talk in a field he didn't know well, he had a favorite question to ask the speaker. "Can you give me a really simple example of what you're talking about?" If the speaker couldn't oblige, Feynman got suspicious, and rightly so. Did this person really have something to say, or was this just fancy technical talk parading his scientific wisdom? If you can't make a hard problem relatively simple, you are probably not going about it the right way. Simplification is not just for beginners. Biology has its model organisms, species that have been carefully chosen to ease the path of the experimenter. They reproduce swiftly in the lab, are relatively safe and easy to handle, and, once they have been studied by many teams, are well mapped and understood. The fruit fly, the laboratory rat, the zebrafish, the squid, for its giant nerve axon, the nematode worm Senior habditis elegans, and Arabidopsis thaliana, a hardy, fast-growing plant related to mustard, the first plant to have its entire genome sequenced. Artificial intelligence, AI, has its own simple cases known as toy problems, which, as the name suggests, are deliberately oversimplified versions of serious real-world problems. Many of the most interesting programs devised in AI are solutions to toy problems, such as getting a computer program to build simple structures in the blocks world, a virtual world consisting of a tabletop with a bunch of movable children's blocks on it. Playing chess is a toy problem. It is certainly more tractable than driving a car from Maine to California, or solving the Arab-Israeli conflict, or even making a sandwich of appropriate ingredients found in a kitchen. Ethicists have their trolley problems. In the simplest version, a runaway trolley is heading down a track where, if it is not diverted, it will hit and kill five people who cannot get off the track. There is a switch that you can throw that will divert the trolley to a sidetrack, where it will hit and kill a single person. Do you throw the switch? Here is a toy world for helping people think about determinism, the idea that the facts at one moment in time, the location, mass, direction, and velocity of every particle determine what happens in the next moment, and so on, forever. Physicists and philosophers and others have argued for several millennia about whether our universe is deterministic, or whether there are some genuinely undetermined events, utterly unpredictable, random events that just happen without anything causing them to happen. Even experienced thinkers may find new insights by playing around with life, the breathtakingly simple model of a deterministic world created by the mathematician John Horton Conway and his graduate students in 1970. Life is played on a two-dimensional grid, such as a checkerboard, using simple counters, such as pebbles or pennies. Or one could go high-tech and play it on a computer screen. It is not a game one plays to win. If it is a game at all, it is solitaire. The grid divides the plane into square cells, and each cell is either on or off at each moment. If it is on, place a penny on the square. If it is off, leave the square empty. Each cell has eight neighbors. The four adjacent cells, north, south, east, and west, and the four diagonals, northeast, southeast, southwest, and northwest. Time in the life world is discrete, not continuous. It advances in ticks, and the state of the world changes between each tick according to the following rule. Life physics. For each cell in the grid, count how many of its eight neighbors are on at the present instant. If the answer is exactly two, the cell stays in its present state, on or off, in the next instant. If the answer is exactly three, the cell is on in the next instant, whatever its current state. Under all other conditions, the cell is off. That's the only rule of the game. You now know all there is to know about how to play life. The entire physics of the life world is captured in that single, unexceptioned law. While this is the fundamental law of the physics of the life world, it helps at first to conceive this curious physics in biological terms. Think of cells going on as births, cells going off as deaths, and succeeding instants as generations. Either overcrowding, more than three inhabited neighbors, or isolation, less than two inhabited neighbors, leads to death. By the scrupulous application of our single law, one can predict with perfect accuracy the next instant of any configuration of on and off cells, and the instant after that, and so forth. In other words, the life world is a toy world that perfectly instantiates the determinism made famous by the early 19th century French scientist Pierre Laplace. Given the state description of this world at an instant, we observers can perfectly predict the future instants by the simple application of our one law of physics. Or we could put it this way. When we adopt the physical stance toward a configuration in the life world, our powers of prediction are perfect. There is no noise, no uncertainty, no probability less than one. Moreover, it follows from the two-dimensionality of the life world that nothing is hidden from view. There is no backstage. There are no hidden variables. The unfolding of the physics of objects in the life world is directly and completely visible. If you find following the simple rule a tedious exercise, there are computer simulations of the life world in which you can set up configurations on the screen and let the computer execute the algorithm for you, changing the configuration again and again according to the single rule. In the best simulations, the scale of both time and space can be changed, alternating between close-up and bird's-eye views. In addition to the configurations that never change, the still lifes, and those that evaporate entirely, such as the diagonal line segment, there are configurations with all kinds of periodicity. The flasher has a two-generation period that continues ad infinitum unless some other configuration encroaches. Encroachment is what makes life interesting. Among the periodic configurations are some that swim, amoeba-like, across the plane. Then there are the eaters, the puffer trains, and space rakes, and a host of other aptly named denizens of the life world that emerge as recognizable objects at a new level, analogous to the design level. This level has its own language, a transparent foreshortening of the tedious descriptions one could give at the physical level. For instance, an eater can eat a glider in four generations. Whatever is being consumed, the basic process is the same. A bridge forms between the eater and its prey. In the next generation, the bridge region dies from overpopulation, taking a bite out of both eater and prey. The eater then repairs itself. The prey usually cannot. If the remainder of the prey dies out as with the glider, the prey is consumed. Poundstone, 1985, page 38. Notice that something curious happens to our ontology, our catalog of what exists, as we move between levels. At the physical level, there is no motion. Only on and off, and the only individual things that exist, cells, are defined by their fixed spatial location. At the design level, we suddenly have the motion of persisting objects. It is one and the same glider, though each generation is composed of different cells. Notice, too, that whereas at the physical level there are absolutely no exceptions to the general law, at this level our generalizations have to be hedged. They require usually or provided nothing encroaches clauses. Stray bits of debris from earlier events can break or kill one of the objects in the ontology at this level. Their salience, as real things, is considerable but not guaranteed. To say that their salience is considerable is to say that one can, with some small risk, ascend to this design level, adopt its ontology, and proceed to predict, sketchily and riskily, the behavior of larger configurations or symptoms of configurations without bothering to compute the physical level. For instance, one can set oneself the task of designing some interesting supersystem out of the parts that the design level makes available. This is just what Conway and his students set out to do, and they succeeded majestically. They designed and proved the viability of the design of a self-reproducing entity composed entirely of life cells. Grinding away deterministically on its infinite plane, it would copy itself perfectly, and then its copy would copy itself, and so forth. It was also, for good measure, a universal Turing machine, a two-dimensional computer that, in principle, can compute any computable function. What on earth inspired Conway and his students to create first this world, and then this amazing denizen of that world? They were trying to answer, at a very abstract level, one of the central questions of biology. What is the principal complexity required for a self-reproducing thing? They were following up the brilliant early speculations of John von Neumann, who had been working on the question at the time of his death in 1957. Francis Crick and James Watson had discovered DNA in 1953, but how it worked was a mystery for many years. Von Neumann had imagined in some detail a sort of floating robot that picked up pieces of flotsam and jetsam that could be used to build a duplicate of itself, and that would then be able to repeat the process. His description, posthumously published, 1966, of how an automaton would read its own blueprint and then copy it into its new creation, anticipated in impressive detail many of the later discoveries about the mechanisms of DNA expression and replication. But in order to make his proof of the possibility of a self-reproducing automaton mathematically rigorous and tractable, von Neumann had switched to simple two-dimensional abstractions, now known as cellular automata. Conway's life world cells are a particularly agreeable example of cellular automata. Conway and his students wanted to confirm von Neumann's proof in detail by actually creating a two-dimensional world with a simple physics in which such a self-replicating construction would be a stable, working structure. Like von Neumann, they wanted their answer to be as general as possible, and hence as independent as possible of actual earthly, local, physics, and chemistry. They wanted something dead simple, easy to visualize, and easy to calculate, so they not only dropped from three dimensions to two, but also digitized both space and time. All times and distances, as we saw, are in whole numbers of instants and cells. It was von Neumann who had taken Alan Turing's abstract conception of a mechanical computer, now called a Turing machine, and engineered it into the specification for a general-purpose stored program serial processing computer, now called a von Neumann machine, and in his brilliant explorations of the spatial and structural requirements for such a computer, he had realized and proved that a universal Turing machine, see Part 4, could, in principle, be built in a two-dimensional world. Conway and his students also set out to confirm this with their own exercise in two-dimensional engineering. It was far from easy, but they showed how they could build a working computer out of simpler life forms. Glider streams can provide the input-output tape, for instance, and the tape reader can be some huge assembly of eaters, gliders, and other bits and pieces. What does this machine look like? Poundstone, 1985, calculated that the whole construction would be on the order of 10 to the 13th power cells or pixels. Displaying a 10 to the 13th pixel pattern would require a video screen about 3 million pixels across at least. Imagine a screen with the high resolution of your laptop or iPad, a half a mile wide. Perspective would shrink the pixels of a self-reproducing pattern to invisibility. If you got far enough away from the screen so that the entire pattern was comfortably in view, the pixels, and even the gliders, eaters, and guns, would be too tiny to make out. A self-reproducing pattern would be a hazy glow, like a galaxy, pages 227 to 288. In other words, by the time you have built up enough pieces into something that can reproduce itself in a two-dimensional world, it is roughly as much larger than its smallest bits as an organism is larger than its atoms. You probably can't do it with anything much less complicated, though this has not been strictly proved. The game of life illustrates many important principles and can be used to construct many different arguments or thought experiments, but I will use it to illustrate just 3 points, leaving you to discover others for yourself. First, notice how the distinction between the physical stance and the design stance gets blurred here. Do gliders, for instance, count as design things or as natural objects like atoms and molecules? The tape reader that Conway and his students cobbled out of gliders and eaters and the like must count as designed if anything does. But its ingredients are quite raw materials, the simplest things in the life world. Nobody had to design or invent the glider. It was discovered to be implied by the physics of the life world. But that, of course, is actually true of everything in the life world. Nothing happens in the life world that isn't strictly implied, logically deducible by straightforward theorem proving, by the physics and the initial configuration of cells. Some of the things in the life world are just more marvelous and unanticipated, by us with our puny intellects, than others. There is a sense in which the Conway self-reproducing computer pixel galaxy is just one more life macromolecule with a very long and complicated periodicity in its behavior. This nicely illustrates a parallel point about biology and the origin of life. Amino acids, one might say, just are. They didn't have to be designed. But proteins, composed of nothing but amino acids, are too fancy. They are at least sorta designed. Darwin's gradualism makes yet another appearance. Second, the life world, being deterministic, has a perfectly predictable future for every possible configuration, but, somewhat surprisingly, its past is often perfectly inscrutable. Consider the still life consisting of 4 on pixels in a square. You can't tell from looking at it, or even looking at it and its neighborhood, what its past was. To see this, note that any three of the four pixels on would lead in the next generation to this still life of four pixels on. Whether any of those cells were off in the past is an inert historical fact. Third, recall how important noise and collisions were in creating the mutations that evolution, like other creative processes, feeds on? Conway's huge construction reproduced itself, but it couldn't mutate. It would always make a perfect copy of itself. And in order to introduce mutations into the picture, the whole construction would have to be enlarged many-fold. Why? Because the life world is deterministic. So the only way a random mutation can occur is if some stray bit of stuff wanders, pseudo-randomly, onto the scene and breaks something. But the smallest moving thing is a glider. So think of it as like a single photon or cosmic ray moving at the speed of, life physics, light. A single glider can do a lot of damage if it must barely tweak something in the genome of the self-reproducing thing without destroying the genome. That genome is going to have to be very large relative to the glider and quite robust. It might well be provable that evolution could not occur in the life world no matter how large we made the entities, if it turned out that these galaxy-sized assemblages were just too fragile to survive an occasional rain of gliders. 67. Rock, paper, and scissors. Probably every one of you knows the game of rock, paper, and scissors. Two people face each other and count, 1, 2, 3, shoot, and each, simultaneously, extends a hand either clenched in a fist, rock, with a pair of fingers extended, scissors, or with the palm flat open facing down, paper. Rock breaks, beats, scissors. Scissors cut, beat, paper, and paper covers, beats, rock. Unless both players display the same hand symbol, a tie, one player wins and the other loses. It's a tantalizing game because if you can outguess your opponent, you can seem to read her mind and come up with the right hand shape to win consistently. It's unnerving when that happens. Can some people play the game better than others? Apparently, since there have been tournaments with large cash prizes in which national and international winners have emerged, and this is important, since every tournament has to be won by somebody, even if there is no skill involved, the better players have a history of winning.